Hector Barreto grew up in an entrepreneurial immigrant family that believed in hard work. His father even had him in his quote-unquote executive training program, which early on consisted of waiting tables in the family restaurant. And that training must have taken hold because that zeal for hard work carried through Hector's life. He eventually headed up the Small Business Administration and the Bush administration from 2001 to 2005 and now serves as chairman of the Latino Coalition. And through those life experiences, Hector has remained grounded in thinking of America as the land of opportunity.
It is like no other country in the world. There is something very, very special. We should never take that for granted. For those of us that have had an opportunity to travel, we understand that we have something really, really special here, and we should always serve to protect it.
We'll discuss entrepreneurship and the policies that encourage it, and Hector shares what he's learned about the Latino community throughout his career. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. This conversation was recorded earlier this year in person at the Bush Center. Welcome to our guest today, Hector Barreto. Hector formerly headed up the United States Small Business Administration, and today he's the chairman of the Latino Coalition. Thanks for waking up early with us to do this, Hector.
Thank you.
And our co-host is Laura Collins. Once again, welcome back, Laura. She's the director in the Bush Institute SME Economic Growth Initiative. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. I only wake up early for this.
I know. To peel back the curtain, we're here at about 7:30 in the morning in Dallas, and Laura and I were comparing notes, and it turns out that neither one of us are morning people. So, Hector, we're looking at you.
The man on West Coast time.
Exactly.
Yeah, the man who's it's like 5:30 in your body clock. Oh, that's rough. Hector is here for our SME Economic Growth Advisory Council, where he is one of the minds that help guide the policy work that we do at the Bush Institute. Because of both of his expertise as the 41st Administrator of the Small Business Administration and because of his work with the Latino Coalition. Let's start with the former. When you were with the Small Business Administration, what was the goal of that department? What were y'all working on?
Sure. Well, the Small Business Administration was actually started in 1953 by President Eisenhower. And there were some small business programs before that, but they unified those all into one agency. And it's really the agency that supports and advocates for America's small businesses. And that role has become even more important over the years. When they formed the SBA, they probably weren't thinking there was going to be over 30 million small businesses in the United States. And I like to say there's nothing small about small business. They really are the engine of America, the engine that fuels the economy of America. Not only are there a lot of them, but they represent over 52% of the gross output of the economy. It's the place that 2/3 of the net new jobs of our economy comes from. And it's also the place that a lot of our innovation comes from that makes us the envy of the world in terms of our economy. So very, very important agency. A lot of people have heard of it, but they oftentimes don't know everything it does.
Where does your passion for small business come from?
Oh, well, that's easy. I was fortunate to be born into an entrepreneurial family. So the first business owners I ever met were my mother and father. And my father was especially a serial entrepreneur. He loved business. He loved starting businesses. I'm not sure he loved running them. My mother ran the business.
He's an ideas man.
Yeah. But so I learned a lot about small business. I used to joke that everything I learned about business, I learned in a Mexican restaurant because that's where I worked when I was a little kid.
What jobs did you hold with your parents?
Oh, a lot of them. We were an immigrant family, and there was five children. My mother had five children in 6 years. I have four younger sisters. And so we were all recruited to my father's executive training program very early on. So we all had to work. I remember waiting tables when I was 9 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And then as I got older, I got more and more responsibility and helped run some of those businesses and start some of those businesses. And my father had a number of different businesses. We started off with the restaurant business because that's an easy business to access. But then later on, he had a little import-export business, a little construction business. None of those businesses were ever really large, but they were very important to our family. They helped support us. They helped educate us. And we learned a lot about being in business and working with the community and customers.
And so your father came to America to start these businesses?
He actually didn't. My father was an immigrant to the United States in the late 1950s. I don't think he was planning on staying that long. But he met my mother. My mother is also from immigrant parents from Mexico. They fell in love, and of all places, they started their journey in Kansas City, Missouri. So that's where I was born. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. And my father, you know, he had a lot of different jobs, as a lot of immigrants do when they first get here. His first jobs were picking potatoes for 50 cents an hour in rural Missouri.
Wow.
And later on, he worked at a railroad, literally pounding the spikes into the ground. But in the winters, it got too cold. So he moved into, he started working in the livestock business. And it was very difficult, dirty work. He was cleaning out stalls, but at least it was warmer than being outside.
Right.
When he was working at the railroad. Later on, he was a janitor at the school that I would eventually go to. But my father used to always say that he was a business owner. And I would say, Dad, you have these jobs. You're not a business owner. He'd say, no, that's what I have to do right now. But eventually, I'll own my own business. So he was very passionate about that. He always wanted to work for himself.
So then he starts these businesses, and his career trajectory just starts trending just so far up. How did that start happening?
Yeah, my father was a very visionary leader, very charismatic. When we were growing up, he used to say, you know, I came here with nothing. I didn't know anybody. I didn't speak the language. I had no money. I had no power. But I believed in myself. I was willing to work hard. And this is such a great country that affords us the opportunity to go as far as we want to go. We're only limited by our own imagination and our own commitment. So he started these businesses. But later on, my father was kind of an organizer as well. And he wanted to belong to the Chamber of Commerce. This was in Kansas City. You know, there were a number of other Hispanic businesses that were there at the time. And my father started asking, where's the Hispanic Chamber? And they said, well, there isn't an Hispanic Chamber. My dad said, well, there should be. And if nobody else is going to start it, I will. So my father was one of the founders of the Kansas City Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. That was in the mid-70s. And later on, he said, well, you know, there are a lot of Hispanic businesses all around the country. I'd like to be part of a national chamber of commerce. And his friend said, there is no national Hispanic chamber of commerce.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. My dad said, well, that's not right. There should be. So if nobody else is going to do it, I'll try to do it. So he started organizing with other leaders around the country, and they formed the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Now, that was in the late 70s, and we were getting ready to get into a presidential election. And my father didn't really know anything about politics, and not so much about policy either. And he started asking around, and his friends said, well, we're Hispanic and we're Democrats, so you should work with the existing administration, which was the Carter administration. My dad said, that's fine. So he tried to reach out to the campaign, and they really weren't interested. They were focused on other things. And my father wasn't upset. He didn't get mad. He just said, well, I really don't want to work with anybody that doesn't want to work with me. And just as it happened, he was reached out to by the Reagan campaign. My dad didn't know very much about Ronald Reagan. He heard that he was the governor of California, but they really convinced him that they were very focused on the small business piece. They wanted to do better in the Hispanic market. My father started working with the Reagan campaign. Obviously, Ronald Reagan won that election. And later on, my father was asked to be part of the transition team to advise on SBA, of all things. And later on, to be a surrogate for him internationally, especially in Latin America. And the chamber just took off during those years, the 80s. And they had a very good, close working relationship. It just so happens that at that time, my father started working with the vice president, because the president couldn't go to all the conventions and all the meetings. So dad started working with Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. And they hit it off as well. They became good friends. My father also helped George Herbert Walker Bush when he decided to run for president. And then just a little point of privilege here. Years later, I was in California. I was working in a business organization called Latin Business Association. And I'd worked my way up because I didn't know anybody in California. My father said, best place for you to meet people is at this chamber, this organization that works with us. So I worked my way up and I finally became the chairman of the board. This was in 1999. My father called me up and he said, hey, I know you're getting ready to have your big convention out in Los Angeles. Why don't you invite the governor of Texas to come and speak? And I, of course, I was a smart aleck, and I said, Dad, who's the governor of Texas? And why would I invite the governor of Texas to speak at my event in California? He says, well, the governor of Texas is George W. Bush. And I think he's going to run for president. And you ought to meet him. And you ought to invite him out to your event. So I did. This was in 1999. And ironically, initially, the campaign was getting going. And they thought, well, you know, California, is there, are we going to get any support? So I had to kind of talk them into it.
Right.
So they came out in late 1999. This would have been about September, October of 1999. And they didn't know if there was going to be anybody there. We had 3,000 business owners at the LA Convention Center to listen to the governor of Texas. And it was my fortune that Governor Bush at that time decided to basically give his first campaign speech at my event. Little speech called Leave No Child Behind, which ended up becoming the Education Initiative. And obviously, one thing led to another, got to know the governor. He asked me to join the campaign. I'd never been involved in a campaign before. And so I became one of the co-chairs in California and then ended up being a surrogate for him during the campaign for Hispanic groups, especially business groups. And then after the campaign, I was honored and privileged that the president asked me to come back and run the SBA.
So that was a pretty good piece of advice that your dad gave. Go ahead. And like, why don't you see what you can do about the governor of Texas?
My father always gave me the best advice, and luckily I followed most of it.
Well, and isn't that's the beauty of America, is that this man who was picking potatoes and a janitor, he becomes an advisor to the president. His son becomes an advisor to the president. Like, that's America.
It is, and it's one of the things that makes us so grateful and proud that we are part of this country. It is like no other country in the world. There is something very, very special. We should never take that for granted. For those of us that have had an opportunity to travel, we understand that we have something really, really special here, and we should always serve to protect it.
You talked before about small businesses really being the engines of America. And, you know, obviously with your work with the SBA, your dad's work with the Hispanic Chamber, and now your work with the Latino Coalition, you're working with a lot of small business owners, a lot of people who are very entrepreneurial. Most of America is not like that. So, you know, what do you think are the things that we could do to sort of jumpstart that entrepreneurial spirit in America? And what are the barriers that you see to some of the business owners in your coalition?
Great question, Laura.
That's why she's here. Yeah, she's the brains.
Great question. I agree with you. Not everybody is going to go into small business, but you know, we have 30 million small businesses in the United States. Women are starting businesses faster than any other group, especially Latina women, 5 times faster. And it is one of the things that has enabled us to be the powerhouse that we are. Other countries used to come and visit me at the SBA and say, how do you do it? How do you do it? We want to do what you guys do, because they saw how this grew the middle class and all of the opportunities and innovation that was created by these small businesses. But many times those countries don't have the kind of, first of all, they don't have the environment. They also don't incent those small businesses. And it's not something that is actually promoted. In fact, sometimes the opposite is promoted. Don't go into business. It's too risky. If it doesn't work out, you're going to be ruined forever. And I used to tell these countries, I said, we're not like that. You know, a lot of our folks, the most successful people that we have tried multiple times before they were able to succeed. We try to support them. Also, most everybody knows the small business owner. They're in their family. They worked at a small business. The small businesses that they know are in their neighborhoods. So that should not change. However, some years back, we noticed that less people were starting small businesses. And that, I think, was somewhat of a byproduct of what happened during the financial meltdown of 2008, where people got very, very risk averse, especially young people. You need young people to want to be able to go out and create something from scratch and with no guarantees. We're starting to see that change, especially as the economy is starting to grow. But critically important for our future, and I meant what I said, we are the envy of the world because we're able to do things that no other country is able to do it. And we should never lose sight of that and forget how we got here. And we should kind of double down on creating some of those opportunities. Opportunities that come from organizations or government agencies like the SBA, chambers of commerce, you know, local governments, state governments. There's so much that we can do to help small businesses, because 50% of small businesses fail in the first 4 years. And it's not because they don't have a good idea. They simply don't know what they don't know. And usually when they start figuring it out, it might be too late. So if you can help a small business in those first 4 years, their chances of success grows exponentially.
So you said you're seeing younger people start businesses more. Do you see that more as, you know, my cohort, the millennials, sort of the mid-30s on up? Or are you seeing that, you know, with the generation, is it Generation Z, the even younger?
I think that's all right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it kind of runs across the board, and I'm not an expert on this, but some young people have said, you know, we don't want to do what our parents did. We think they were focused on the wrong things. We want to be focused more on things that are, in our minds, more meaningful for the future and different issues. Don't want to take the risk, and also don't feel like they want to, you know, go into debt and buy a house and all some of those things. So you see some of that, as you know very well, Laura, immigrants are great entrepreneurs. They are so excited. They're like, you mean I could work as much as I want to and keep most of the money? This is the greatest thing in the world. I can't do that in my home country. Women for many years were not encouraged to start businesses, and more women are creating business and they're being very successful and they're great entrepreneurs and they bring a total different skill set to the equation. But I think anything that we can do to educate people on what the opportunities are, and again, I sometimes say it's the hardest job you'll ever love, because it's not, you know, sometimes people have these idealistic notions of what it's going to be like to be in business. You have plenty of free time, money.
Oh, you have no free time.
Yeah.
And you don't get to take, there's no PTO.
No.
And I will tell you, it's the exact opposite. You'll pay everybody before you pay yourself. You'll work more hours than you've ever worked in your life. But the satisfaction that you can get from it and the independence and freedom is just phenomenal.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned the immigrants starting businesses. And I think the last time I checked the statistics, it was they start businesses at twice the rate native-born Americans do. Immigration in this country obviously is very stuck. And this is a conversation you and I have had offline. This is a conversation that, this is something we talk about all the time at the Bush Institute. When you are out amongst your coalition and your business owners, you know, is the sense from them that we really do need to fix our immigration system?
Absolutely. And it's very frustrating because we know what a great country we have and we've tackled some major, major problems. You know, we put people on the moon.
Yeah. I mean, we can't vote for comprehensive immigration.
We can't figure that one out. Yeah, that's too complicated for us. Unfortunately, it has become so politicized, and I hate to say it, and you know, I've talked about this. I think both sides get what they need out of that debate, and they're almost incented not to fix it. But we need to fix it for the good of our country, for the security of our country. It makes all the sense in the world. I think there's a lot of good ideas out there. I don't think that we need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to have some convictions and some
political will.
Some profiles and courage that we don't have right now.
What is the role of the Latino Coalition? So you head up the Latino Coalition now. As we talk about immigration and talk about small business, what is the role of the work you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, Latino Coalition is an organization that's been around for over 25 years. And we're a national membership organization. We're an advocate for the interests of the Hispanic community, especially small businesses. We provide different tools and advocacy for them. We do some very high-profile events. We're launching some tools that we think that can help them get more business. And so I kind of think of Latino Coalition like AARP for the Hispanic community. And AARP, many people know, the Association for Retired Persons, says that they're a national advocate for 50 million constituents. Their constituents are called seniors. Our constituents are called Hispanics. They also get very involved in policy. They at any major issue, they're on the front lines advocating for them. They provide services for those members. And so, you know, when we grow up, we want to be as successful as the AARP does. And so that's kind of the way that we structure ourselves. Again, the three pillars for us, which are really the three pillars in the Hispanic community, and they don't really change. It's the economic empowerment, especially as that relates to our businesses and the jobs that we need in the economy. Education, K through 12 and higher education. But I would extend that even further. Education throughout your life, especially as you need to obtain different skills to be competitive in the changing workforce. And healthcare. Hispanics are still very underrepresented in terms of getting access to healthcare. They've made lots of promises by former administrations that didn't come true. And so that's still an issue that we've got to focus on and try to come up with some strategies. Preferably more private sector strategies to helping them get access to the healthcare that they need.
One of the things that I'm always struck by in this conversation of, you know, what Hispanic voters or just Hispanics generally really desire or believe in or want from their government, they're the exact same things everybody else does. And so it's always so funny to me that there is this sort of divide, because we are all sort of pulling in the same direction. We all care about our families.
So true.
We all care about, you know, how we're going to put money in the bank and food on the table and how our kids are going to be educated. And do you find that you're in DC a lot, you're talking to a lot of lawmakers. Do you find that that's something that they understand, and they understand when they're trying to reach out to, and they're making policy, that everyone's opinion, sort of, we're all pulling in the same direction, and that these are things that don't need to be necessarily divided?
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's an ongoing challenge. Many legislators have very few Hispanics in their districts, especially in the South. You know, a lot of our population, we're in all 50 states, and we're 18% of the population, 60 million strong, $2 trillion in purchasing power. But a lot of those lawmakers, and this is both sides of the aisle, but
oh, totally.
A lot of those lawmakers really don't get it. They, you know, one of our continuous jobs is to demystify the Hispanic community. And you remind me of a story I heard one time. One of the first Hispanic lieutenant governors in California was a gentleman by the name of Cruz Bustamante. And when he got elected, this is many years ago, the reporters would all ask him, what is the Hispanic plan, the Hispanic strategy? You must have like this secret Hispanic strategy. And he was like, he didn't know how to answer that. And finally, he said, okay, I'll tell you what the secret strategy is. Are you ready? Here it is. We want good jobs. We want to live in a good neighborhood. We want to send our kids to good schools and hopefully have higher education. We'd like to have a little money for retirement, and we're concerned about security. And the reporter said, that's not a secret plan. That's what everybody wants. And he said, exactly.
Spoiler alert, right.
That's exactly what we want. And I think sometimes maybe lawmakers try to complicate it. And maybe sometimes complicate it because they think they can get a certain advantage, an electoral advantage, if they're saying certain things. One of the things that, you know, we sometimes complain about, for lack of a better description, is that we're noticed every 4 years. But after that, between those 4 years, in other words, when there's a presidential election, everybody wants to talk to Hispanics and see what they want and see if they can get their votes. In between time, it's not so much. And so we've got to, you know, Hispanics are mainstream. We're a young population. We will be 25% of the U.S. population in the next 30 years. We're very patriotic. We love this country. But we're also bicultural, and we're also bilingual, and we don't want to lose that as well, as many other immigrant populations have discovered and emphasized over their evolution in this country.
Can you talk a little bit more about that bicultural? And I think that, and having worked in immigration for the time that I have, one of the broad misconceptions, particularly about Hispanics, is that they don't assimilate or integrate, whichever word you prefer, and they don't become fully American. And you and I both know that's just completely false, and that you don't have to abandon your roots in order to fully embrace your new country. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that and your family's experience with that?
Sure. Another great question. I heard a demographer one time, very well-known demographer in California, David Hayes Bautista, good friend at UCLA. And this is many years ago. And we were doing an event that was titled Demystifying the Hispanic Market. This is like going back over 20 years ago. And he said, oftentimes that question is presented in the wrong way. He said, it's not an either or proposition. He said, the immigrant mother who is raising her U.S. born children here knows that those children need to assimilate, need to acculturate to be successful. She loves those children. She wants them to have every opportunity. So they're going to learn English. They're going to go to school. They're going to stay out of trouble. They're going to do all the things that you need to do to be successful. He said that our immigration patterns are different. He said in many years past, a lot of our immigration came from overseas. And when they got here, they knew they were never going back.
Right.
All right. So some of them, you know, for years would try to hold on to their, you know, ethnicity and their cultural heritage.
The number of German language newspapers that existed in the United States pre-World War I is huge.
Yes,
and people
is.
Forget that. But
it is. You know. And many schools only taught in German.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But our Hispanic population, obviously, first of all, my father would say, we didn't go anywhere. We were already here.
Yeah.
we were already here.
But, we're Texan. We know that history.
Yeah.
But he would say it's an and proposition. Hispanics are going to assimilate. They are going to culturally, and they're going to hold on to the things that they grew up with, the food that they grew up with, the customs that they grew up with. That's a vital part of their identity and their heritage. And these things are not mutually exclusive, and they do not also diminish their love of this country, because they're American. Remember, 90% plus of Hispanics have no issue with their immigration status. And yet, the things that oftentimes they're asked about is immigration. And immigration can become a very polarizing issue, especially the way that both parties approach it. But I totally agree with you that Hispanics are already here. They're not going anywhere. Most of the population growth now is childbirth. It's not immigration anymore. And we've got to get our immigration system right, because in the future, we will need additional skilled workers to come to this country. We're not producing enough of them ourselves. So we better get that right.
Absolutely.
Well, and every immigrant kids is so acutely aware of that. Their parents made sacrifices to come here, and that those parents are here because of what they want for their kids. And did you feel that pressure knowing what your parents did and what their sacrifices they made and wanted to be who you are today?
I absolutely did. Well, first of all, Kansas City was not a bastion of Hispanic culture, so we kind of stood out a little bit. So I knew that we were different there. And of course, you hear all those stories from folks, especially your parents, and some of the really challenges that they had. And as I mentioned to you, my father said, "I came here with nothing. I was able to accomplish something. I expect a lot more out of you." you didn't have any of these challenges, so you better do a lot better than I did. So I've constantly tried to work towards that towards that end. But yeah, you do feel it. Now, I would mention one thing. Many years ago, some parents felt the best thing for their children would be for them not to say that they were Hispanic, pretend they were something else. And they were doing that to try to protect their children because of racism and bigotry. And now some of those kids have grown up, and I know some of them, and they're kind of disappointed that they didn't learn more about the culture. They didn't learn the language. They didn't go back to the old country. And so they're trying to kind of catch up with that. So we go through these different cycles. And we're going through a cycle right now, the cycle of the other, But to your point, the other is us. We're the same. We're,
right.
we should be rowing in the same direction.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. And so there's a question that we usually ask our guests at the end of our episodes. And we always ask either, what should we be talking about as a nation that we're not talking about enough? Or what's a question that no one has asked you that you wish they would? And so we're feeling magnanimous today. So which one of the two would you like to answer?
Oh, I'll answer both.
Okay, yeah.
Show off.
Well, I think you've touched on some of these issues, and I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation. Our country's changing very quickly, very, very quickly. In all kinds of different ways. Technology is changing our country, and there's nothing we can do about that. It's going to continue to accelerate. So we've got to understand how that works in our life and what things that we need to do to get ready to deal with it. And it's almost dizzying, the rate of change that's going on. Demographic change is changing, and we're all in this together. So we better find better ways to communicate and work together. The environment is changing. I mean, the literal environment is changing, and we got to figure out what we're going to be doing about that. So markets are changing around the world. We cannot just be so insulated to be looking internally. We've got to be looking at around the world. I sit on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce board, and Tom Donahue always says 95% of the consumers live outside of this country.
Yeah.
We better figure out how to be talking to them. So those are some of the things that we need to talk more about. These are not easy problems to solve. It's going to require a lot of policy, but it should be top of mind on the radar screen all the time, all the time, all the time. Other countries are thinking about those things. We ought to be thinking about them too. And the other question that I don't get asked a lot about, but it's something that I've grown up with, is why are Hispanics conservative? And why aren't Hispanics monolithic? And why don't they all think the same way? And of course, that's almost a ridiculous question, because no community thinks exactly the same way on every issue. We're a diverse community. We think differently about a lot of issues. But my father used to say, and that was kind of like the rationale behind creating the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, there's so many more things that we agree on than the things that we don't agree on.
It's true.
So let's stipulate there's some things that we're not going to agree on, and let's focus passionately on the things that we do agree on and create more solutions for everybody.
President Bush often has said multiple times, like, if you focus your energies on what you agree on, you can get a heck of a lot done. Laura, do we have enough time to ask him about tequila?
Yes, we do.
All right.
I've heard, but have never had the privilege of sampling your tequila.
Well, we'll make sure that changes very, very quickly. I'll try to make this quick. The last project my father was working on, and I didn't realize this because I was in government at the time, was he bought a ranch and he planted agave. And so he was planning on making tequila at some point in time.
He planted it here in the U.S.?
No. You can only make tequila in Mexico. And the state that he was from, Jalisco, is where 80% of the tequila comes from. So he bought property and he planted the agave. My father, unfortunately, got sick and passed away in less than a year. When I went down to Mexico, his lawyer said, "What do you want to do with all the agave?" And I was like, "What agave?"
I beg your pardon?
Yeah. And he said, "Your father bought a large ranch and he planted agave, and it takes 7 years for the plant to mature, so we'll just pull it out of the ground and throw it away." I said, no.
Wait a minute. Don't do that.
So 7 years later, we harvested the crop, and I went to some friends of ours, which was the Beckman family, which is the Cuervo family. And they're like, "What are you doing? You're not in the tequila business. Why are you doing this?" I said, "It's a tribute to my father." And they said, "Oh, that's a great name for tequila. Why don't you name it that?" So we did. And so we made tequila. We sold through most of it, but I will tell you that I'm developing his land now, and we're building a tequila factory this year.
Oh, that's so fun.
On the land. So stay tuned. More to come.
Oh, great. We have to keep him around.
Yeah, I was saying, next time you're in town, we expect a sample, at least.
You'll have it, I promise.
Hector, thank you so much for doing this. I know you had to wake up early and you're on West Coast time, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew and Laura. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to the next opportunity.
Absolutely.
Take care.
You can learn more about the Latino Coalition at www.latinocoalition.com and about the Bush Institute's work in immigration at www.bushcenter.org/immigration. If you enjoyed this episode of The Strategist, please tell a friend or leave a review online. You can also send us a note on social media at The Bush Center on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you for listening.